Hi everyone, it's me Tim.
And me Camille. And what you're about to hear is the second half of our two-part series about art and activism 3 years after Ferguson.
All this happening and Mike Brown was killed, and I just felt like I have to go. I have to somehow be there and stand with people and be a part of it. I can't just be a, you know, so-called armchair activist.
It was my turn, it was our turn to step up.
That was Sabaa Foleon and Damon Davis. The two produced the new documentary, Whose Streets?
It chronicles the activism and activists that sprung up following the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson 3 years ago.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county lines, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Texas police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
So far, the film has been getting great reviews.
Even some early Oscar buzz.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, riot gear, and canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you heard about.
When Sabaa and Damon were making their film, people living here in St. Louis had choices to make. Some chose to lead or participate in activism, to raise their voices and organize against systems built by racist ideas.
For me, like all the reporters at St. Louis Public Radio and most at other local news outlets, the choice was already made. We covered it. Rank-and-file police officers and first responders had their jobs to do.
But most people sat it out, or maybe watched the nightly wall-to-wall cable news coverage of confrontations between activists and police.
But Sabaa and Damon chose to document.
To bear witness.
And as artists and filmmakers and storytellers, we are not naive to the history and the lineage that we're working in and how black people have been portrayed over and over and over again. We are portrayed as either superhuman or subhuman. And those pieces that are in between is the mundane, is the everyday life. And you will never see a person as a whole human being if you can't see the parts that aren't as cool and as glorified. And other filmmakers and other artists and other storytellers don't have to answer this question because they have already gotten an opportunity to do it.
Today's show is all about the choices that come along with opportunity.
Damon and Sabaa talk about why and how they made Whose Streets and how they hope all their choices will make a lasting path forward.
We'll also hear about a choice a good friend of ours made while covering Ferguson that continues to shape all the choices he makes now.
And note that you won't be hearing from us much on this episode.
Because on today's show, our choice is to listen.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
As promised, Camille and I are going to push pause on us for a little bit and push play on parts of an interview with the producers of the documentary Whose Streets.
They talk about what got them to this point, the process of creating the film, and what's happened since.
This is our story to tell. Nobody else should be relegated or allowed to tell this story. But us. But us.
Sure. My name is Sabaa Foleon. I'm one of the directors of Whose Streets.
And my name is Damon Davis. I am also one of the directors of Whose Streets.
So when Mike Brown was killed, I was in the last 3 weeks of my job at a nonprofit in New York City, which focused on reentry, so helping incarcerated people put their lives back together or connect with their families while they were in prisons or jails. And I started to speak out on social media, just kind of as an impulse reaction. And I was just ranting. And people were really responsive to it. And people would message me and approach me, you know, who knew me and thank me for what I was saying and tell me that it was very informative to them. And so, you know, I really took that to heart. And I was like, okay, well, this is something that people are responding to. Maybe I should pursue this. So all this happening, Mike Brown was killed, and I just felt like I have to go. I have to somehow be there and stand with people and be a part of it. I can't just be a, you know, so-called armchair activist.
I'm a native of East St. Louis and just a creative by trade. So I went out there, I think it was the third or fourth day with my brother, because I had been watching how things were going from via social media, and I hadn't actually stepped foot into Ferguson before that. So I went out there with my brother and during the day, and I saw that it was absolutely nothing like what was being portrayed by the media. And so from that point on, for lack of a better word, I was out there. I stayed out there and I protested for a while. And at some point I had got pulled into the organizing aspect of it.
You know, when I came into it, I had this job ended. I moved out of my apartment, packed all of my stuff up, moved it into storage, called my friend up, can I crash on your couch? And went to Ferguson. And, you know, I really had to drop my whole entire life, and this became my life. And it's a task that I willingly accepted.
We got the first thing! We got the first thing!
We also knew that for it to be really, really legitimate and in the spirit that we wanted to do it in, that we had to collaborate with someone from the community. So we were telling everyone we could talk to, you know, you can collaborate with us if you want to, however deeply you want to be involved, we're open to it. And people just kept directing us to Damon Davis, Damon Davis, Damon Davis.
The universe was pushing me towards that, and it pushed me towards her, and then it pushed us in a direction to do it.
I personally have always really resonated with Black resistance and people like James Baldwin, like W.E.B. Du Bois, people like Harriet Tubman, people in our history who have been resistant and articulate and eloquent, and have been part of this legacy of kind of like Black sociological analysis that is so rich, have always inspired me.
I come from a lineage of people that were resistant. And like my parents are much older. They're like, my parents had me at 42. My mom and dad are 75 years old. So they remember colored water fountains. My father integrated the school in East St. Louis. My father was a Black Panther. My mom was a sharecropper. They have lost people to violence due to racism in real life. You know what I mean? And like, I was raised in a tradition of that, of resistance and being awake. I was being exposed to things and people and a history that I honestly can say that a lot of my friends around me in East St. Louis was not getting that same kind of education. And I felt like I had an obligation to those people that had gotten me through life, that had gotten me through high school, that, you know, that put clothes and food in front of me just to not let them down. I felt like it was my turn, it was our turn to step up. And like, I felt like I had to get out there and do it to make sure that I didn't drop the ball for all of these sacrifices that these people made. I mean, I personally was scared as hell. Like, I was afraid. I wasn't. It was not glorious. It was not a. It wasn't a movie. It was not. It was not as romantic. Is the word. It was not as romantic as I thought it was going to be. It was not as romantic as people talk about it when you see footage from the original civil rights movement and you did like you can be removed from that because you were not personally in danger and the people you love and standing next to you were not personally in danger. This was the real deal. Like, this was not a joke. It was like you could go to prison. You could be killed. You could be just be personally injured for the rest of your life. Like, it was just not a dress rehearsal. And that was the thing that I remember. And even telling people now, and people that ask like how about it, and how I try to be as truthful with people as possible. And I do not try to deify myself or anyone else. I do not try to make it seem as though it was for fun. It wasn't. Like we were in danger and we still are. You know what I mean? So like that's the thing that I remember is like it's real work and it's really dangerous.
Our director of photography is white and Honduran and, you know, appears white or perhaps mixed, but definitely not brown skinned. And so that created an interesting dynamic because he was afforded a certain amount of safety when it came to the police that I didn't have, because even, you know, the time that I was arrested while filming, I had the camera on me. Usually I wouldn't have a camera and I was just directing. But this day I actually had the camera, so it was clear that I was filming and I was still arrested and he was not. So to recognize that, like, I can't really go over there. I can't go up to those police and just ask them questions. I can't go behind them to get that angle because they're not going to allow it. But he could. And I think on the other hand, being a white presenting person, he may have had more difficulty just coming up to the protesters with the camera and building that level of trust. It has always been kind of this tightrope for me, because there were moments where I'm standing there and I'm watching what's happening and I can't be involved because I don't want to draw extra attention to myself as part of the resistance. I need to be separate so that I can be the observer. We saw that nobody was really investing in that. Nobody was really investing in trying to figure out what this situation is. People were invested in the story of today or tomorrow, the scandal, the update about the case, these different things, but we didn't see people investing in, like, what is the human truth of this situation? And I think that takes time for people to actually sit and see more than a 2-minute broadcast and sit together in a big room and process all of these emotions and go on a whole journey, so that you can actually get a sense of what this is and what this energy is and what it means and why we're, you know, at this point.
Artists and filmmakers and storytellers, we are not naive to the history and the lineage that we're working in and how Black people have been portrayed over and over and over again. We are portrayed as either superhuman or subhuman. And the those pieces that are in between is the mundane, is the everyday life. And you will never see a person as a whole human being if you can't see the parts that aren't as cool and as glorified. So not only do we have to... We are vessels for our own pain. We have to be vessels for other people's pain. We have to be priests for other people. This story is for everybody before us and people that are not even born yet. And somebody has to put this in a can and capture the essence of what it is. And maybe the chronological order is very important, but what is the feeling that the people in the streets had? And so that when you come up against this kid that's not even been born yet, you will know that somebody has already felt this. You know what I mean? So look at what they did, and maybe you'll find some answers that you won't have to figure out by just stumbling through like we had to do. We had to stumble through, and we had to push on like sheer courage. And the same thing goes for us. Somebody had to do this already. You know what I mean? Somebody did this. They fought this. It was different weapons, and it was the faces were different and the names were different. But this is a pretty old story. It's as old as this country itself. You know. So this has been one of the most difficult things I have personally had to walk through. I am grateful to have the opportunity to do it, but I also know that like I have to sort through a lot of stuff that I went through, that I saw. There is no time to do that because we have an obligation to do this for a community.
I just got an interesting conversation with someone really close to me, and they're kind of thinking about going into film or television, and they were like, I'm kind of envious of you. And it was really, really hurtful to hear, because it never leaves my mind the fact that someone had to die for this to be a thing. It never leaves my mind that my access was access to something really, really tragic. And I think that I don't know how to reconcile that except to say that somebody has to do it, somebody's gonna do it, and so I'd rather it be me because I know that I'm not in it for my career.
I make it very clear that like this shit don't come for free either. Like the pain and the mental problem, like none of those things come with it too. So just because I get to sit here and do interviews don't mean that I'm an inch away from tears every time I talk about it. And I got to talk about it every day. You know what I mean? There is real baggage that comes along with all this stuff that people think they want. You know what I mean? That people think that they so envious of. I give you this shit, like straight up. You can have it. You can have it. And there's been days that I'll be like, you can have this shit. You know what I mean? But it's the cards have been dealt, and I'm playing them the best way I can. You know what I mean? But I struggle with it all the time. I struggle with it all the time.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
Coming up, we switch gears and hear someone whose job it is to decide which art gets covered in the media.
And how those decisions changed after Ferguson. Reporters make lots of little decisions every day about who they talk to, what they cover, and how they cover a story.
And let's be honest, sometimes people in our business don't do the best job examining how that shapes larger narratives.
For our good friend and St. Louis Public Radio arts reporter Willis Ryder Arnold, Ferguson was a turning point.
He gives us this essay about how a single choice he made days after the death of Michael Brown changed the way he does his job, even today.
Hundreds of people are in the middle of West Florissant Road, a four-lane street running through Ferguson, Missouri. It's been the heart of nightly protests. A McDonald's sign hovers over the crowd to my right like some weird corporate moon. It's hot, and the air is thick with humidity. I'm covered in sweat. Insults are being hurled at cops, who are wearing full riot gear. I'm watching 20 or so officers form a line across the width of the road. More officers stand behind them. On previous nights, it's been followed by people in the crowd throwing water bottles, or even rocks and bricks. The cops have reacted to this with overwhelming force. Arrests, tear gas, and sometimes a sound cannon. The muscles in my neck and back stiffen with anxiety. For the moment, though, there's an empty space in the center of the road. I badly wanted to take a photo from there. When any non-white person ran across the street, the cops bellowed and threatened arrest. So, in that moment, I chose to conduct an experiment. While I calmly framed my photo, I started counting in my head.
6, 7.
People dashed across the street behind me.
10, 11.
The cops yelled at someone.
13, 14.
How long can I, a white guy with a press
17,
badge, stand
18,
here?
19, 20, 21.
Why did I make that choice in that moment? Just a few months earlier, in the fall of 2014, I was living in New York, working for a streaming arts radio station and freelancing. I was deep in the arts hustle. Within 3 minutes of meeting someone, you knew if they could use you, you could use them, or who you had in common. I needed out. I wanted to find today's downtown New York in the 70s, before it became a Time magazine story. I thought maybe I can find it somewhere else, somewhere less transparently ambitious and jaded. I saw a job opening for an arts reporter at St. Louis Public Radio and moved halfway across the country. And I figured I'd be spending my time at gallery openings, enjoying cheap living and solid local beer. Then came August 9th, 2014. I suddenly found myself spending hours walking along the same half-mile stretch of road in the brutal Midwestern heat. I helped with breaking news coverage and saw peaceful protests and significant conflict between people and police. I came to St. Louis to be an arts reporter, but how am I going to be an arts reporter in this new world?
In the meantime, we are staying on top of a developing story this morning. A local 18-year-old...
While I was wrestling with this question, something started to happen.
Now we return to yet another aspect of the recent troubles in Ferguson. The Sound of Music comes to Ferguson this weekend as part of a project to help the town's young people and help heal the wounds from those recent troubles.
Brother, can I speak to you? A moment, can you stay? Tell me how you live in a world that needs repair.
Songs were released by Brian Owens.
Doesn't take your
Tef Poe.
Racism, the conduit to white power. Jay Nixon.
Mastermind.
Don't shoot.
And later Jack Grelly.
Folks said it felt like we gone back 50 years.
Plays were written. Artists met to discuss whether they should focus on art making or putting their own bodies in the street. All this activism, all this art, there was no separation between the two. I found a new focus for my work as an arts reporter. Looking back at it now, I realize so much of this clarity was honed by that single choice I made, standing between nervous cops and activists. In the middle of the street, counting,
56, counting. 57, 58, 59, 60.
I made it to 60, before any cop yelled at me. Coming face to face with that privilege underscored just how important it is to make room for other perspectives and to be inclusive in all aspects of my reporting. I need to spend that time covering musicians that band together to raise funds for local immigrants, a painter's work that challenges the gentrification of a predominantly Black and Latino neighborhood, or a new art exhibit that details cultural appropriation by corporations. These choices aren't as dramatic as the one I made in Ferguson 3 years ago, but I hope, collectively, they have a much greater meaning.
We Live Here is produced by me, Camille Stanley.
And me, Tim Lloyd. Sheila Newman is the executive editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.